Chapter 18, My ADHD Activism. In 1993, the year after my diagnosis, I attended the first conference in the U.S. for adults with ADHD held at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. While reading a book on the shuttle bus from the airport to the university, a man named Tom, whom I didn't know, repeatedly tried to converse with me. Given that he was interrupting a stranger reading on a bus, I should have realized sooner that Tom had ADHD and was going to the same conference. It turned out that Tom was from Tacoma, and a few months after the conference, we started a support group in our hometown for adults with ADHD, using space provided free by a local hospital. Of course, we did not know how to run such a group and faced many challenges. Our first challenge was keeping the participants on topic. People with ADHD have a hard time with that and veer off on tangents they consider relevant, but their listeners find irrelevant. We lack filters, and it's hard for us to focus. We need to start at the beginning and share the entire history of something instead of focusing on the immediate situation. We see the big picture, but often get lost in irrelevancies. As the group leader, I wanted to be polite and encourage participants to talk freely. They would not return if they did not find the meeting helpful. Yet I became fidgety and irritable when I didn't have the skill to keep the speakers on track. Besides meandering talkers, a few participants talked on and on. I could not restrain myself and cried out, "You've talked long enough!" Carol, one of the talkative ones, took offense. She came to the next meeting armed with a stopwatch to time everyone who talked. She commented after each speaker, "I didn't talk as long as that." Our support group had additional problems. Each month, new people came, and each new arrival had to tell his or her life story. This left no time for returning participants to share what was happening in their lives. Many people arrived late. Because the group members varied each month, participants did not get to know one another well enough to establish trust and be open about their situations. A last concern was the range of challenges the participants faced. Some were financially well off, while others were on food stamps and Medicaid. A few had done well in life, while others were living borderline lives. We could not find common ground to discuss the group's needs and problems. Yet sometimes we did find common ground, as we all had ADHD. A 21-year-old named Sam touched us with a story about how life can quickly go south. One day, late for work, a cop stopped him for speeding. Sam's vehicle registration had expired. He got a speeding ticket, his license was suspended, and he was ordered to appear in court with a valid registration. Sam kept driving with a suspended license. He could not pay for the new registration and the ticket unless he continued to work. Was stopped again by the police and got a larger fine. Sam forgot his court date and lost his job for being late too often. We all related to his story. We understood how our minor issues become big ones because of distraction, running late, procrastinating, or forgetting. If only Sam left for work on time. If only he renewed his registration when it was due. If only he remembered his court date. We fill our lives with regrets and if-onlys. Because of the numerous challenges we faced, our support group disbanded. I tried to think of another way to help adults with ADHD and switched to a different format, a monthly speaker with information helpful to people with ADHD, followed by a Q&A. Another hospital gave us free use of its auditorium one evening a month. The meetings were held for 15 years with 30 to 40 attendees each month. The new format worked better, but not perfectly. People sometimes interrupted the speaker with their questions. Some presenters were more skilled than others at managing the audience. During the Q&A, several participants took a long time explaining their situations before asking their question. I created a schedule for the upcoming 6 months and promoted the meetings by bringing flyers to the offices of pediatricians and psychiatrists. I needed to prepare myself emotionally for the group's initial meeting because I would out myself publicly for the first time as someone with ADHD. The previous support group was small, with only 5 or 6 people, and it was confidential. I had an ADHD friend there, so I didn't feel alone. This meeting was different. It would be a much larger public meeting, and not all attendees might have ADHD. I felt more exposed and vulnerable, mainly because I was visibly in charge. I felt the pressure to model healthy ADHD behavior, announcing I have the condition without making it a huge deal. How could I announce I have ADHD when I was ashamed to have it? Fortunately, I had a role model who dealt with his ADHD in a healthy way. A man who openly told one and all, I have ADHD, without feeling diminished by saying it, Dr. Edward Halliwell. A presenter at the conference in Michigan, Dr. Halliwell was a graduate of Harvard and Tulane Medical School. He self-diagnosed his ADHD after hearing a professor lecture about the condition in children. He told me he was never reluctant to say, I have ADHD, because he never believed it was anything to be ashamed of. I wanted to get to the same stage of mental health, able to tell anyone without anxiety or shame. To prepare for the meeting, I visualized saying to a packed auditorium, my name is Cynthia Hammer and I have ADHD. Practicing this wording aloud made my stomach queasy and my mouth dry. My voice quavered as I spoke, and that was unacceptable. I sat in the privacy of my car and said my introductory piece repeatedly until I could say without apprehension, without fear, I am Cynthia Hammer and I have ADHD. Still, I was unsure if I was ready to go public. I was committed to being open and honest, but I remained scared. What if someone who knew me was at the meeting? Would the audience accept me after it learned I have ADHD? Would people wonder about the quality of the presentation if someone with ADHD organized it? At our first meeting, instead of the 100 attendees I visualized, 35 people sat in the audience. Announcing I have ADHD was easy. After my first public disclosure, it became easier and easier for me to tell others. I learned that most people quickly forget because it is not as important to them as I worried it would be. With time and the new life Dr. Smith predicted for me, having ADHD became less important to me as well. I even became comfortable talking to community groups about ADHD. Once, when speaking to a Rotary group at a luncheon, I used a metaphor about eating to help them understand the life experiences of living as an adult with ADHD. I told them the following story. Susie Smith was born with one hand tied behind her back. No one, not her parents, her friends, or even her teachers, noticed this. Even Susie did not realize there was something different about her. Susie was remarkably dainty whenever the school cafeteria served soup, never slurping, never spilling. When she left the table as neat as she found it, others commented, "What a sweet, lovely girl, so proper and well-mannered." On other days, the school cafeteria served meat. Susie needed 2 hands to cut it into bite-sized pieces. She did poorly on these days. It took her a long time to eat, and often she did not finish. She was messy, leaving scraps and drippings on the table and floor. People were surprised and thought she was messy on purpose. They would say, "What's wrong with you? Why are you messy today? If you tried harder, you would be successful." Susie endured her childhood hearing disparaging comments almost daily. Then one day, when she was 35, she was eating fish tacos in a fancy restaurant. The server blurts out, "Why are you eating with one hand tied behind your back?" Imagine Susie's surprise and relief as she understands why she struggled all those years. Imagine her despair as she comprehends how different her life would have been if only someone had noticed her hand tied behind her back sooner. However, just by knowing she has this limitation, Susie stops being so hard on herself. She understands there are others in her situation whose lives are as constrained as hers. Susie wants to find out what it's like to be two-handed, but untying her hand is a complex process. Few doctors learned in their training that people have this condition. Even doctors knowledgeable about her situation are still trying to figure out the best way to free her hand. What medication? In what dose? Will it even help? Susie is fortunate. Her doctor, after several false attempts, frees her hand with the right medication. Yet no amount of treatment or therapy will make her released hand function perfectly. Diagnosis and treatment freed the hand tied behind Susie's back. But that is all it does. That is all it can do. What Susie does with her hand once freed is up to her. If Susie wants her released hand to be useful, it will take motivation and work. Medication is only part of the treatment. Pills don't teach skills, as they say. Any improvement after medication is up to Susie. She must strengthen the muscles in her hand that have been unused since birth. She has to learn and practice coping skills and acquire new habits. Some people deny that they have one hand tied behind their back. They deny that having only one good hand causes problems. Some even believe being one-handed gives them special abilities. They worry that if they untie their hand, they will lose their inclination toward risk-taking, novelty-seeking, creativity, empathy, and love of learning. They decide not to have their hand untied. I did not like having one hand tied behind my back. Sure, it gave me a few special abilities, but also several disabilities. I wanted to reduce my disabilities and maintain my special abilities. So far, it is working. Although Susie's story is not directly about me living with undiagnosed ADHD for 49 years, I never tell this story without getting emotional. My hurt feelings come flooding back, and my voice quivers. People in the audience with this disorder also get emotional. They share their experiences of living with an unrecognized disability and recall the times others made belittling and negative comments about how they performed. They understand the cost of living with just one hand. I would tell them that recovering from ADHD is like climbing a circular staircase. Each improved habit we adopt, like putting the credit card back where it belongs or getting to appointments on time, moves us another step up the circular staircase. Each step up enhances our lives, increases our control, and strengthens our self-esteem. In 1994, 2 years after starting the ADHD support group, I founded and headed the nonprofit organization ADD Resources to help adults learn about ADHD. My position allowed me to use all the positives, risk-taking, novelty-seeking, empathy, creativity, and love of learning, and challenged me to keep the negatives at bay. My experience as co-president of the League of Women Voters gave me the confidence to start ADD Resources that I led for 15 years. Many organizations hire an attorney to create a nonprofit, but I did not. I read the requirements, completed the application, and the IRS approved our organization to be a nonprofit, a 501c3. I continued to be reluctant to hire experts when I could learn to run a nonprofit on my own, not by getting a degree in nonprofit management. I created our website after a friend taught me the basics. I managed the organization's finances by learning to use QuickBooks. An ADHD positive that I have always valued is my need to undertake interesting activities, not to be bored and not to be stuck in a rut. The challenges I faced and the expertise required made growing ADD Resources interesting and exciting. Because I was starting a new organization, I used my creativity every day. At first, ADD Resources existed at my desk in our home's basement. When I started the organization, all three sons lived at home. After they moved out, I converted one bedroom into my home office. I was unpaid. Although, after being the director for 10 years, I received a salary of $1,000 monthly for unlimited work hours. Working for ADD Resources was my labor of love, my joy. Within a few years, we hired a part-time secretary and then committed to renting office space. After a few more years, we rented a larger office space. My risk-taking was at work when we assumed expenses without knowing how to pay for them. The same risk-taking excitement was at work when we invited national authorities to present at our conferences, never sure the conference receipts would cover their fees. One of my ideas was to compile articles written by adults with ADHD and the professionals who diagnose and treat us to produce a 125-page booklet called the ADD Reader. It was popular because adults with limited attention preferred reading short articles containing concise information. The Reader was only available to members of ADD Resources. Membership also gave them a discount at our conferences and allowed them to borrow books, videotapes, and audiotapes from our lending library. Our membership grew to over 800 adults with ADHD. Before we hosted our first conference, I scoured the area for a centrally located facility with a reasonable rental fee and free parking. Foster High School in Renton met all the criteria, and for many years we held our conferences and workshops there. We used the cafeteria for book sales and food service, the classrooms for breakout sessions, and the main auditorium for keynote addresses. As our organization became widely known, the phone rang every day with people calling for advice about their concerns. At first, I enjoyed answering the callers' questions, but over time, I didn't want to hear any more life stories. My empathy for adults with ADHD was better expressed through managing the organization's activities. I was relieved when our secretary, Joan Jaeger, had a remarkable ability to talk with the people who called for support and advice. I was the director of ADD Resources for 15 years and grew it to national prominence. I hired staff, learned bookkeeping, organized monthly public meetings, and wrote and published a monthly newsletter. We sponsored an annual conference with national authorities as presenters and over 300 attendees, including adults with ADHD and the professionals who helped them. We provided workshops for teachers to educate them about ADHD and how to help the children in their classrooms with this diagnosis. I could not have created this organization before my diagnosis and treatment. Dr. Smith was right. I have a new life. A reporter interviewed me about ADHD for our local newspaper and asked, "What has changed since your diagnosis?" I had little to tell her. Maybe because my diagnosis was 13 years earlier, and the improvements were subtle, gradual, and seemingly insignificant. But what a difference they made. Having my clothes in order, knowing where I put my keys and credit card, creating and sticking to a list, completing even tedious tasks, remembering things I needed to do, still a challenge. Being aware when I was interrupting or tuning out, and starting and finishing tasks on time. It may have embarrassed me to tell the reporter of these seemingly minor achievements. They sounded trivial, simple, and easily achieved by most people. I finally told her, before my diagnosis, I could never have established and become the executive director of a nonprofit organization called ADD Resources. I could never have made this nonprofit prosper and become a national organization that helped thousands of adults with this disorder learn about their condition and how to improve their lives. My answer impressed her and helped her understand how different my life had become. I thrived as director of ADD Resources. Even though I continued to have challenges, I recognized my strengths, having creative ideas, organizing successful events, and motivating volunteers. I stayed calm and confident, helpful when putting on events, as they always have stressful moments. I learned not to worry and to go with the flow. Sometimes I had unrealistic expectations for our conferences, visualizing 500 or more people attending. When that was not to be, I made a mental switch and focused on hosting the best conference regardless of attendance. Steve helped by telling me, "ADD Resources is a nonprofit. Your focus should be on helping people, not on making money. Adults with ADHD perform well in crisis because we hyper-focus and zero in on the important things that need to be done." Two episodes come to mind where I dealt with potential crises at our conferences. First, the keynote speaker for one of our annual conferences, Dr. Peter Jensen, a psychiatrist on the staff of Columbia University, was coming from New York City. Although I called his office several times for information on his travel plans, I had not heard from him. Dr. Jensen had not told me where he was staying and whether we needed to pick him up. By 8:30 a.m., he still had not arrived, and he was to present at 9 a.m. Quickly shifting gears, I approached a local physician attending the conference. "Dr. Mandelkorn, can you be our keynote speaker if Dr. Jensen doesn't arrive in time?" He said, "I'm glad to fill in. Let's see if he gets here." In typical ADHD fashion, for he too has this diagnosis, Dr. Peter Jensen strolled in at 8:40 a.m., splendidly dressed in a pink and black pinstriped shirt and a darker pink bow tie. "I'm so glad to see you," I said. Then, sounding slightly annoyed, I asked, "Where have you been?" He replied, "I have family that lives in the area and was visiting with them. Are we set to go?" For another conference, our work crew arrived 2 hours early to set up for book sales, registration, and coffee service. When we arrived, the janitor said, "All the electricity is off in the building. There's been a major power outage in the neighborhood, and we haven't learned when it will be restored." After a few moments, while we digested the information, the janitor returned and said, "The junior high just a block away has power, and I got permission for your conference to relocate there." I said to the volunteer crew, "Okay, gang, let's get to work. Two of you help the janitor hang a sheet in the gym for a screen and set up chairs for 250 people. Joan and Judy, take care of registration. The rest of you help Nancy set up the food and Deborah set up the bookstore. We'll work out where the breakout sessions will be during the keynote presentation." Everyone hustled and we started the conference in the new location just 15 minutes late. We managed extremely well in this emergency. As director of ADD Resources, I continued to make verbal commitments to ensure my follow-through. By telling one or two friends what I planned to do, I made sure I did it. I learned not to promise more than I could deliver. Having gigantic ideas is inspiring, but if we have a profusion of ideas that go unrealized, people lose confidence in our organization. My ADHD challenges have never disappeared, but have become less burdensome over the years. My improved self-talk that I have practiced since I heard Selma Freyberg's presentation. My optimistic approach to life, thanks to Dr. Seligman. My medication and my efforts to improve my performance have all helped me be successful. Serving as the director of ADD Resources made me competent and confident. I used my strengths and developed new skills and abilities. It, so far, has been the most rewarding 15 years of my life. However, after 15 many years, the work became repetitive. Because I lacked fresh ideas and inspiration, I resigned and found a new challenge, serving as an ADHD coach. During my coach training, I was surprised to learn it required an entirely new body of knowledge and skills, very different from what I learned as a social worker. Instead of focusing on emotions and insights, I helped clients focus on problems, strategies, and goals. As a coach, I was more active and talkative in the helping process, analyzing challenges, and assisting the client institute lasting changes. It was satisfying to observe the growth in my clients, and I enjoyed coaching for several years until I finally retired. Myth: children who take ADHD medications will become drug abusers. Fact: research demonstrates that children who take their ADHD medication as prescribed into adolescence have no more increased drug usage than teenagers without ADHD. Treating ADHD with medication reduces the likelihood that a child with ADHD will abuse substances. These findings make intuitive sense, as ADHD medications reduce the symptoms of the disorder that lead to illicit drug use.